Where did we leave off last time? Causes of variance. Intentional causes of variance are prompted by the best of motives. A scribe may be correcting an apparent error, and actually he's introducing an error. Instead of correcting the manuscript, he's introducing a variant. This was done especially in difficult or obscure passages. There are certain places in the New Testament where either doctrinally or historically or geographically or some reason there is a difficult reading. And lo and behold, there's always a variant there too, because copyists have changed it and made it more understandable. A famous doctrinal passage is 1 John 5:7. There just appears to be doctrinal dishonesty at work where somebody has added that to the text. Also, the word fasting is added in the Gospels, and that may have been doctrinal as well. Did we talk about writing materials, papyrus and parchment? One of the earliest types of writing materials were wax tablets. Zacharias in Luke 1:63 wrote on a wax tablet, and he wrote the word John. Well, wax tablets were convenient, but they certainly weren't permanent, and to write the New Testament on wax tablets would have been extremely cumbersome. Wax tablets were good for short things. They were like blackboards. You could erase them and use them again. Papyrus, which our English word paper is derived from, spelled P-A-P-Y-R-U-S, papyrus originated in Egypt. Papyrus comes from the papyrus plant that grows along the Nile River. The oldest known piece of papyrus dates 2400 B.C. And it was used extensively in Greece from about the 7th century B.C. and on. Papyrus was fairly inexpensive compared to parchment, which is leather. Fairly inexpensive. It was used for letters, receipts, business correspondence, just everyday writing material. Papyrus was cut out of the pith of the papyrus stock, and usually they used 12-inch pieces, which they would slice like this. There's lots of different sizes, and then they'd lay them this way and they'd smooth them together with a stone or a shell or something. And this is one sheet. And then these sheets would be attached together, and of course they'd be wound on spools called rolls or scrolls. The first page of a scroll is called the protocolon, which we get the English word protocol. Protocol. A book is called, in Greek, was biblos, or biblia, is the plural. Pen and ink are mentioned in 3 John 13. Pen and ink, 3 John 13. Paper and ink are mentioned in 2 John 12. Paper and ink. Ink is the Greek word melan, M-E-L-A-N, which means black. M-E-L-A-N. And paper, there is the Greek word C-H-A-R-T-E-S. Papyrus was made into charts. Of course, you can see the English word there. C-H-A-R-T-E-S. Papyrus was exported extensively from Egypt and was a common writing material until about the 3rd century or 4th century AD. And for classical literature, it was used up to the 6th and 7th century AD. It seems very probable that the original writings of the New Testament were written on papyrus. Papyrus is economical, but it has two drawbacks. One is, it's perishable. Only papyrus in Egypt has survived. It will not survive a wet climate. It will mold and then disintegrate. But there are papyrus, many papyrus, that have survived in Egypt. A second drawback of papyrus is that the writing surface isn't as smooth as leather. Parchment or leather can be made into real nice writing material. Real smooth, real nice. Papyrus just isn't going to be that way. Now, discovery of papyri began in the mid-1700s. A whole library was found. And there have been numerous large collections of papyrus found in Egypt. Did I pass that picture around? That guy sitting in that room? Well, I got a picture here of what this is like. They find these collections of papyrus. This is about the turn of the century. That guy is sitting in a room with mounds of papyrus on all sides of him, and he is seeking to identify each piece by reading it. Is it somebody's will? Is it a letter to somebody's aunt? Is it part of a book? What is it? And each one of these pieces or scrolls, whatever they amount to, is read and identified and cataloged. This takes a lot of manpower, and there's lots of papyrus that is sitting in museums and in other places that's never been collated, and eventually scholars will get around to it as time permits. Parchment, then, is made of animal skins. Cattle, sheep, goats, antelope. I read you that one statistic that Thomas Nelson Publishers uses 1 million square feet of leather every year just for Bibles. That's only the covers. Now, if we're talking about pages and writing on leather, we're talking about a lot of leather. The animals were cattle, sheep, goats, and antelope, and oftentimes the young were used. They produced better skins. Fine quality parchment is called vellum. V-E-L-L-U-M. Vellum. The oldest known piece of parchment dates 1500 B.C. 1500 B.C. Parchment is still used today over in the Near East on occasion, and it's also used by Jews who want to preserve some of the traditions and culture of the past. They're still using this, some of the Jewish sects. By the 3rd or 4th century A.D., parchment was the most common writing material. Our manuscripts from the 4th to the 14th century are all almost exclusively parchment. There's a few stray papyrus manuscripts that date 6th and 7th century, but just a few. Manuscripts 4th century and earlier, let's say 3rd century and earlier, are exclusively papyrus. Exclusively papyrus. And in the 4th century, there's a little bit of both. Paper. There are no manuscripts on paper. Paper was invented by Chinese. The oldest specimen in the 4th century AD. Paper wasn't introduced to the Western world until the time of the Crusades. And about the 12th century AD, paper began to be common in Europe and by the 15th century AD replaced parchment. Shortly before the invention of the printing press, paper had replaced parchment and, of course, set up the printing press, made it much more economical. Writing styles. So much for writing materials. As far as dating manuscripts, we have about the 4th century as a division between papyrus and parchment. 15th century is the end of dating of manuscripts. Anything later than that isn't considered anything, manuscript worth anything. No, papyrus is the early. We'll put the autographs here. 1st century autographs. There's a few of these right in here, but just a handful. Now, writing styles. There's two styles of writing among the Greeks. It's very similar to our types of writing. One is cursive, and the second is uncial. Uncial spelled UNCIAL. Now, English-speaking people, we have longhand and we have printing. This is basically cursive and uncial. Cursive is a running longhand or a fast hand, and uncial is individual letters deliberately, carefully drawn, each letter separate from the other. And so we're familiar with that. We learn how to print block letters in first grade. About fourth grade, we start learning longhand. Now, there's one more difference between these two, and that is, among the Greeks, cursive was not used for books. Cursive was used for letters, receipts, deeds of various kinds, other communication, but uncial was used for books. Of course, our books today are always print. They're typewritten in print. They're never longhand. And so this was the way it was among Greek literature. Always uncial for books. Cursive was used for everyday writing. Now, for the uncial changed about the 9th century. Right about in here, in the 9th century, we have uncial here. And then after this, we have a new kind of writing called minuscule. Minuscule is a evolution of uncial that was done for economic reasons. Number one, minuscule is a blend of cursial and uncial. It's to make uncial smaller letters to use up less leather, and the letters are more run together so that more could be written in a shorter space of time. Minuscule is quicker to write, and it takes up less space. So now we have another difference in the manuscripts, and that's the writing style. If a manuscript is on papyrus, we know it's an early dated manuscript. If a manuscript is minuscule in leather, we know it's 9th century or later. If it's leather and it's unsealed, we know it's between the 4th and 9th century. These are broad categories. Now, 90% of our manuscripts are right here. 90% are minuscule. 10% are unsealed. And there's two reasons for this. The first is that a lot of the early ones are lost. And the second is the demand for manuscripts was highly increased at this later century. So a lot more manuscripts were made. A lot of the early ones disappeared. In fact, we don't have anything of the first century. They've all been lost. And I know of only one manuscript in the second century. Well, there's a few they date late second century, but, you know, they're kind of hedging maybe. There's a number in the third century and the fourth century. So all the early ones have pretty much been lost. Now, this leads us to manuscript classification. Manuscript classification. The first classification is unsealed. Now, by definition, an unsealed manuscript is going to be a manuscript in this category right here. A second category is minuscule, and it's going to be in this category. And the third category is papyrus, and they're going to be in this segment. So all manuscripts have been divided into three categories, and this is just for convenience. And then we're talking about a certain manuscript. I mean, what is it? Well, we know what it is because we know what category it falls in before we ever do anything with it. Now, among the unseals, I have 266 manuscripts. Now, perhaps there are more, and this figure could be updated. But Kurt Alland is generally recognized as the man in the world in charge of cataloging these manuscripts. So any new manuscript that comes to light or is discovered by anyone, he keeps the list and examines these and catalogs them. By the way, his name's in the front of this. And in the front of this UBS text, he's one of the men that's put this thing together. He may be the world's authority on this. I don't know. Either he or Metzger or Wittgren. But he's in Germany, and he keeps a master list of these. 266 cataloged unseals. These unseals are abbreviated by a number prefixed by a zero. So all unseals have a number starting with a zero, and then whatever comes after it. That right there tells you what this manuscript is, and if you know anything about it, that information is given you. Papyri manuscripts are abbreviated with a P and then a superscript number. That tells you it's a papyri, and it's papyri number 45. This is unsealed number 32. And minuscules are just an Arabic numeral. 426. That's minuscule 426. And if it's at all important, it'll be listed in the front of UBS text, which lists all the important manuscripts. There's a lot of them that aren't that important, and so they don't list those. 426 is, let's see, not in this list. So let's see if it's in this list. It's not in this list. So it must not be very important. I just made it up. Minuscules There are 2,754 of these. 2,754. And papyri, 81. Also, in some books, you see an old English P here. You know, something like this. I don't know how to do it exactly, but old English P with the superscript number, that's a papyrus manuscript. UBS lists all the papyri in here since there's only 81. I believe they list them all. I'm pretty sure they do. And they list along a bunch of unseals. Now, one more thing about unseals. Unseals are also given a letter abbreviation. And the letter abbreviation is really more important than the number. Now, not every unseal has a letter abbreviation. Because I said there were 266 of them, and how many letters of the alphabet are there? Well, they use the English alphabet, the Greek alphabet, and the Hebrew letter A. So O32, actually, that's W. That's manuscript W. Manuscript W is a 5th century manuscript of the Gospels. I mean, you'd know that if you knew. You will in this class. If you know anything about W, you know what manuscript it is, what it contains, what its date is, where it's located. There's also A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L. There's each one of those is an unsealed manuscript. Now, generally speaking, the unsealed manuscripts, especially the earlier ones, are the most dependable group of witnesses of the New Testament text. Even though the papyri are earlier, many of them show evidence of having been copied without the greatest care, and so their reliability is not as great as the unsealed manuscripts. There are about 4 unsealed manuscripts that are considered the top of the heap, and probably 3 of those is enough to make this text, just the 3 best. Now, there's a lot more information to work with, and scholars go over everything, but those 3 are so considered so reliable that they are very weighty in textual matters. Go ahead.
Do you know what has become of the Dead Sea Scrolls?
The Dead Sea Scrolls are Old Testament manuscripts. So we don't really study them in this class since we're going to stick to New Testament textual criticism. I will comment on them later in class, and we'll talk about the general state of the Old Testament and textual criticism that applies to it. And at that time, I'll just make a mention of the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls were a real important find, and at first they're overrated. All new finds are always overrated. And then after a couple decades pass, it kind of comes into perspective. But they're very important. They've done, they've done more to validate and confirm the text rather than to really overturn textual criticism in any way. They haven't really added a lot to textual criticism. What they've done is basically prove that our Old Testament text is really reliable. So we'll talk about them later. Then there are some secondary manuscript groups, which we won't really cover in this class, but let me just mention them. First one is lectionaries. Lectionaries, Ostraca. And talismans. Lectionaries are church lesson books. Part of the liturgy that contained quotations from Scripture, mostly of the Gospels. There are no lectionaries of Revelation, but mostly of the Gospels. And lectionaries are abbreviated like this. Ostraca is pottery, talismans are good luck charms. You know, those little things people wear around their necks. If it has a piece of scripture on it, and it dates in the 3rd century, it's a witness to the 3rd century text. Because whatever they quoted is obviously quoting off of some manuscript. Now, obviously we don't have very much here that's going to really help us with textual criticism. But it's just mentioned as a category. There isn't much here either. There's scripture engraved in mugs and plates and different things like that, but not a lot. There's a lot here. Lectionaries, there's 2,135 manuscripts of those. 2,135. Lectionaries, the earliest fragments are 6th century A.D. Most are from the 10th century and on. By the way, there are uncial lectionaries and minuscule lectionaries. The majority are minuscule. There's a number that are uncial and they follow the same pattern, 9th century about as the break. Now, just to look at some of the manuscripts that are important. I want to study 6 uncial manuscripts, a handful of papyri, and 1 minuscule. The first one is O1. Its code letter is Aleph. Kind of a Hebrew A there. This manuscript is called Codex Sinaiticus. Sinaiticus, codex is spelled C-O-D-E-X. All codex means is book. It's a Latin word for book. It's a manuscript in book form. All the manuscripts are books or book form, since there are no scrolls of the New Testament. So they're all codexes. Sinaiticus is spelled S-I-N-A-I-T-I-C-U-S. The name Sinaiticus comes from the monastery at Mount Sinai where this manuscript was found. Found in a monastery at the foot of Mount Sinai. And so it derives its name, Sinaiticus. It's called Aleph, probably more than that, for short. The date of Aleph is 375 A.D. 375 A.D. And these dates, by the way, are almost universally accepted. They're not really controversial. Scholars, for the most part, accept the date 375, and these are dated by the quarter century. You won't find 376 in 3 months. They're dated by the quarter century, and scholars are pretty much in agreement with 375. Now, manuscript Aleph was found by Lope Goat Constantine von Tischendorf. Lope Goat means praise God. Better known as Tischendorf. Tischendorf, you can spell that. Tischendorf is a German physician's son. He received training in Latin and Greek, and he studied theology under Wiener. Wiener's a famous grammarian who wrote a big fat Greek study in the library. And Tischendorf made this a hobby. And at age 25, he got a grant from the Saxony government. He also got some money from his brother, and in 1840, he set out for Paris to recover the original writing of Manuscript C. Now, Manuscript C is number 4, and we're coming up to it, but just a preview, Manuscript C is called the Palimpsest. That means it's a manuscript that has been scraped and reused. And so Manuscript C at one time was the New Testament, and I suppose there was a shortage of writing material. And so a monk named Ephraim scraped off the New Testament and wrote down a bunch of sermons. Nobody is at all interested in his sermons, but everybody is interested in the New Testament that he scraped off. Now, a number of people had tried to recover the New Testament. When you're writing on leather, ink always sinks into the pores, and so there's always just a faint trace of what was originally there. And with the other stuff over the top of it, it wasn't that easy to recover it. Others had tried this and not been successful. Tischendorf was the first one to recover the original writing of C, and obviously this was done with a lot of nearsighted work. And he published this in 1843, 44, and 45. He published the New Testament from manuscript C, which had been hidden from others. By the way, they put chemicals all over the manuscript to try to bring back the original writing, and that made a big mess. And today they found that you can read it clear as a bell with ultraviolet light. So, but Tischendorf didn't get that. He had to do it by hand. Now, as a result of publishing this, he found the doors of libraries all over Europe open to him. And he became famous and accepted. Now, in 1844, he set out for Mount Sinai, the monastery, hoping for great discoveries. The convent was a 12-day trek on camelback from Cairo, Egypt, out into the desert. The convent had high walls, 35 feet. There was no gate. Messages were sent up to those inside the convent via a basket hung over the wall. And if they found your papers in order and decided to let you in, they'd lowered a crossbar and reeled you up via a crossbar, 35 feet up. Now, while he was there, now, when people are looking for manuscripts in those days, they didn't go, you know, out digging a hole someplace. They went in libraries all over Europe, because that's where these things found themselves. They're scattered in libraries all over the world. Somebody had them, they become antiques, it's given to a library, they stick it in the basement somewhere in a box, and obviously nobody's interested in the New Testament in Greek. They can't read it anyway, and so it ends up just stuck away somewhere. And along comes somebody like Tischendorf, combing through all these ruins, and knows what he's looking for, and he discovers these things. And another good place to look was in monasteries in the Near East. The old Eastern Orthodox and other places, especially the real old ones. They had all kinds of things in them. Now, while he was there, he found two garbage cans full of leather leaves, pages, and he asked the monks what these were for, and they said they'd been using them to stoke the fires. Well, he found 43 leaves of the Septuagint. Now, the Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. And he acted so excited that the monks immediately confiscated what he'd found. And he got 43 leaves out of there, but they kept the rest. And so he learned a lesson on that. If you find anything, act like it's not worth anything. It's the old barter technique. This was important because later he found something real valuable. And he was able to play possum long enough to get it out from under their noses. Now, he got this 43 pages of the Septuagint, but they held back a lot more. In 1853, he returned to the convent, just knowing there was more in there. He got nothing. He didn't even find the other stuff that they'd hidden from him the first time. In 1859, he came back again. Only this time, he came under the auspices of the Russian government. Now, the Tsar was the secular head and protector of the Eastern Orthodox Church, which this monastery was of. And so having the Tsar's letters of credentials, you know, and that kind of thing, it gave him more clout at the monastery. Now, he found nothing, but the night before he was leaving, the steward invited him to his cell, and there he found that Old Testament that he had seen. 198 pages more, which he only got 43 the first time, so he had a lot more. Then the man had the whole New Testament, which was manuscript Aleph. Now, Tischendorf acted cool this time, and asked that he could take it to his tent and read it as his, at his leisure. He said it would have been a sacrilege to sleep that night, so he stayed up all night. Now it also contained the Epistle of Barnabas and other apocryphal books, and Tischendorf stayed up all night copying the Epistle of Barnabas. Now Tischendorf was not spirit-filled, and Barnabas was an unknown apocryphal book, and that's why he stayed up all night copying that, not the New Testament. But let's let you know where he's at. Now, he tried to get this thing from the monks, and they wouldn't let go of it. He tried to buy it, and they weren't about to sell. So he went back to Cairo, and he negotiated with the Tsar to get this manuscript. And one way or another, I'm not sure the story, there was recently an article in Reader's Digest on this, where the monks are now alleging, kind of like the North American Indians, that Tischendorf bamboozled them out of their manuscript, was dishonest, etc., etc., and some way or another they're looking to collect on this thing. Well, they got some money and influence, and as it were, the royal, from the Tsar, the royal blessing upon them, should they part with the manuscript, which they did. So Tischendorf took it to the Tsar and gave it to him in 1859. And it remained in Russia until 1933. In 1933, the communist government was hard up for cash, and so they put it up for sale for $500,000. And the British Museum jumped on it. They raised donations from all over the world among Bible Christians. They raised $500,000 and they bought it from the Russian government. Today it sits in the British Museum in a neat little glass case with a humidifier and a thermostat and probably armed guards. No, the whole museum has armed guards. But it sits in the British Museum. If it went for $500,000 in 1933, you can imagine what it's worth today. Then another manuscript. Aleph has an interesting history. Oh, by the way, Tischendorf designated it. See, the other manuscripts already had letters given to them. And he considered this one so important that he couldn't just assign it the letter V, you know. So he grabbed the Hebrew letter Aleph, the first letter in Hebrew, to give it its preeminence and back it up back at the beginning. So that's how come it has the Hebrew letter Aleph. Manuscript 02, code letter A. Called Codex Alexandrinus. Codex Alexandrinus. This dates 425 BC. yes, AD. It gets the name Alexandrinus because the patriarch of Alexandria, Egypt, gave it as a gift to James I of England in 1624. It was given as the gift to James I of England in 1624. Now, the Patriarch of Alexandria got it from a Greek monastery in 1616. And we don't know where it was before that time. It has no known history. And by the way, Aleph has no known history. We don't know how it came to the monastery in Mount Sinai. It may have come there in the 6th century AD. It may have come there 100 years before Tischendorf got there. We don't know. The King of England, in 1757, presented it to the Royal Library of the Nation, which means it's in the British Museum. It sits right next to Sinaiticus in the British Museum in a neat little glass case. Manuscript A doesn't have the complete New Testament. Aleph does. Aleph has the complete New Testament. Manuscript A was originally 820 leaves. 820 leaves. Today it contains 773 leaves. 773 leaves. So you can see it's about 92% complete or something. It's missing Matthew chapter 1 through 25:6. Matthew 1 through 25:6. It's missing John 6:50 through John 8:52. John 6:50 through John 8:52. And it's missing 2 Corinthians 4:13 through 12:6. 2 Corinthians 4:13 through 12:6. It's considered perhaps the best manuscript of the book of Revelation. Perhaps the best manuscript of the book of Revelation. Perhaps P47 is the best, if not manuscript A. These are considered the most reliable in the book of Revelation. Then manuscript O3, code letter B, its name is Vaticanus. Manuscript B, as it's called, dates 350 A.D. 350 A.D. It receives its name Vaticanus because it's in the Vatican Library. In the Vatican Library at Rome. It is the oldest and most valuable manuscript of the New Testament. It's given such weight that by itself, it occasionally will stand against all the other manuscripts. Now, the earliest mention of it is in 1481. It was cataloged in the Vatican Library in 1481. Up until that time, no history is known of its existence. In early centuries, 1600 and 1700s, although scholars knew of its existence, very few of them cared to consult it. Now realize what it meant to be a textual critic in those days. Instead of having UBS with all the footnotes that tells you everything you want to know about manuscripts, what they all have and everything on any given variant, if you were studying in the 1500s or 1600s, you would just have to take a neat little trip right down there to Rome and hit him up for this manuscript. And the library curator probably wasn't that willing to just let anybody walk in and look at things, so you might sit for 5 or 10 weeks in a hotel there waiting to get permission to look at the manuscript. And that's just one manuscript. Then you might have to go to another country to get another one, and another country to get another one, and I mean, this was no easy task. Textual criticism was very difficult in early days because all the information was spread all over Europe. And to get it, you had to go there in person. And so what scholars began doing is they began going there and then collating all that that manuscript had of the variants. And then they began tabulating and collecting all this information. You need all that information before you can even make a text. And so what we have today, this book here, is a result of probably a couple million hours of labor that men have put in going over all these manuscripts. Now today they photographed all the manuscripts, and the New York Bible Society has them all. We've got photographs of everything that you can imagine. And there are other libraries that have this as well. In fact, I saw on a book list a photograph of manuscript A for $100, but I decided I have enough wall ornaments already and I let it slide. Since I can't read unsealed Greek, I figured it would only be a conversation piece, and I already have enough of those, so I didn't get it. Manuscript B was not attracting much attention in the 1600s and 1700s, but in the 1800s, when textual criticism started to really go, and men like Tischendorf were on the scene, the Vatican Library decided not to let anybody see it. Even Tischendorf was not allowed to see it, in spite of all his credentials and everything. Now, they did allow him to see it at one time in 1842. He had letters of introduction and a reception by the Pope, and yet they only let him see manuscript B for 6 hours over 2 days under close supervision. Another scholar went to Rome and spent 5 months there and never even got to look at it. Now, in 1866, Tischendorf was allowed again to see the manuscript 3 hours daily for 14 days. And the monks got very nervous at him because he seemed to stare at the same page for long periods of time. Well, they caught him. He was memorizing it and copying it in his hotel. And they put the squelch on that. He got about 20 pages out of there. Now, they were real stingy allowing anybody to see it, and then later on, 1889 and 1890, they allowed it to be photographed. So it's hard to figure where they were coming from, but there's no mystery now. It's been photographed. Scholars have gone over it with a fine-tooth comb. Manuscript B originally had the whole New Testament. Now it is missing Hebrews 11:14 to the end. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 14 to the end. It's missing Timothy and Titus, and it's missing the book of Revelation. Missing the book of Revelation is the oldest and most valuable manuscript. By the way, Napoleon took it captive in about the turn of the 17th century. Remember when Napoleon ransacked Rome? He took manuscript B as a war booty, took off with it. But he returned it in 1815. He should have sent it to England.
Why do you say that it was complete? Are you just assuming it was complete?
No, scholars know it was once complete of the whole New Testament.
While the Vatican had it, or they're just saying?
No, well, somebody had it. The Vatican probably has everything there ever was. At some point in time, parts of it were lost. Then manuscript 4, which I gave the code letter C to, is called Ephraemi Rescriptus. Ephraemi Rescriptus. Ephraim is the name of the monk who scraped off the New Testament and wrote down his popular sermons. Rescriptus is the Latin word for rewritten. Rewritten. So we have a manuscript that was recycled, or a palimpsest. The date of C is 450 A.D., 450 A.D. Now, of 250 New Testament uncial manuscripts, about 52 are palimpsests. Of 250 New Testament manuscripts of uncial type, about 52 are palimpsests. So we're talking about 20% of the manuscripts are palimpsests. There was a shortage of leather, and they began preying on these manuscripts. Now, manuscript C was brought from the East to Italy in the early 16th century. It was owned by the Medici family. Today it's located in Paris. And Tischendorf is the first one to identify the New Testament and publish it. At one time, it contained the whole New Testament. Now, it has about 61% of the New Testament. About 61%. We'll take a 5-minute break here and we'll finish up these unsealed manuscripts when we get back.